A distinguished older man in a Panama hat approaches you at a funeral, introducing himself as a former patient. Your mind goes blank. You have no memory of him whatsoever. This mortifying moment opens a window into one of psychotherapy's deepest truths. We carry fragments of each other forward, often in ways neither party fully understands. These therapeutic encounters reveal how confronting our mortality, that uncomfortable truth we spend most of our lives avoiding, can paradoxically teach us how to live. The title borrows from Marcus Aurelius, "All of us are creatures of a day, the rememberer and the remembered alike. We're all temporary, yet we desperately seek to matter, to be witnessed, to leave something behind." What happens when we stop running from this reality and turn to face it directly? Paul Andrews, an 84-year-old former Princeton philosophy student, claimed he needed help with a 60-year writing block, but when he presented 45 years of correspondence with his deceased dissertation director, the truth emerged. He was auditioning for a replacement witness. His letters revealed someone who embraced solitude while aching for the nimblest and noblest mind to appreciate his sensibilities. When confronted with this observation, tears filled Paul's eyes. He thanked his therapist and left, having found what he needed, validation that a great man had once deemed him significant. Charles appeared to have it all. Elite education, six-figure salary, panoramic San Francisco condo, prominent wife. Yet his dreams revealed a different story, images of himself as wounded, cowering, fake. In one dream, a film director praised his audition, then rejected him for impersonating an actor. Charles's protest, "If you impersonate an actor, you are an actor," captured his lifelong struggle with authenticity. The darkness traced to age 8, when his Olympic sailor father disappeared during a morning sail. That was the end of the good days, Charles wept. When he found a father figure in tech entrepreneur James Perry, the nurturing relationship paradoxically prompted therapy by reminding him of everything he'd missed. Then Charles learned James had committed suicide, not simply died as he'd first believed. The deception shattered him. Those wonderful, blissful times when he and I sat talking, now I know those times didn't exist. When Charles asked what his therapist was thinking during their session, the honest answer created unexpected intimacy. Authenticity became the antidote to feeling fake. Sometimes healing isn't about fixing what's broken. It's about having someone of stature truly see who we are. Natasha, a 70-year-old former ballerina, clutched a photo of herself at La Scala. "Was I not lovely?" That past tense revealed everything. Her real life had ended 40 years ago, when gout ended her career and Sergey, her brilliant dancer husband, abandoned her. She'd slashed his face with a broken bottle before her breakdown. Despite rebuilding her life as a cello teacher and remarrying, she still idealized Sergey and felt lost outside of her life, experiencing astranaya, not truly present. Her nightmares revealed the truth. Lost in the Congo, hiding in deserted houses, unable to communicate her location. At Molly's funeral, the therapist found Alvin Cross's old files. The radiologist who wrote death sentences had sought help after his estranged brother, Jason, died from lung cancer. Despite professional success, Alvin lived strangely alone. The pattern repeated. "We go out, have dinner, sex is great, then they come to my house. And then it ends." When therapy moved to Alvin's home, the truth emerged. Extreme hoarding, with stacks covering nearly every surface. Alvin terminated treatment, but Molly had quietly helped organize his home for 30 years. Sometimes our symptoms aren't the problem. They're anesthesia against the pain of being mortal. Rick Evans, a 77-year-old former CEO, proudly described his 9 successful careers and reverence for spontaneity. Yet this strength had become his prison. When considering activities like fitness or yoga, he became paralyzed by alternatives and did nothing. His dreams revealed what he consciously denied. One showed him unable to join activities because of offense. Another featured him struggling to clear a foggy mirror. Despite claiming not to think about death, Rick avoided social activities, ate meals alone, and actively resisted forming connections at Fairlawn. His only significant relationship was with his banker son in London. The paradox was glaring. He complained of loneliness, yet avoided relationships, focusing on activities rather than people. Rick later admitted he deliberately withheld the first stanza of Don't Fence Me In, the one explicitly mentioning jail. His insistence on spontaneity wasn't freedom at all, but denial of the ultimate structure confining us all, our limited time remaining. When Astrid, a therapist who had been both supervised and treated for over 10 years, died suddenly from a ruptured aneurysm, her life celebration raised unsettling questions about how well we truly know anyone. Days later, Justine Casey, one of Astrid's nurses, arrived seeking help. Recently diagnosed with malignant melanoma, she described her emotionally draining work, getting close to patients, working desperately to save them, only to watch them die. "I'm just their escort through the valley of death," she explained. Her personal life mirrored this emptiness. Divorced 20 years, with one son she'd written off after his heroin addiction led to imprisonment. Despite close friends, she hadn't told them about her cancer. She described herself as clunky and awkward after losing her mother at 9. In their final session, Justine confessed, "I am dangerous, venomous, I'm full of anger." She revealed she had been the nurse who hissed, not whispered, "Show some class for your kids," to Astrid in frustration and envy. Yet despite her spiteful intentions, her words had profoundly helped. When asked to imagine a row of people you've helped, Justine could see them, both the living and the dead, stretching into the distance. Sometimes our wounds become the very instruments through which we heal others. Sally arrived with a declaration. "I want this to be different from our last consultation. This time, I want a complete overhaul. My 60th birthday is approaching, and I want to change my life." Her true calling was writing, not her lifelong career as a physics technician. She'd won a prestigious literary prize at 18, but published nothing since, calling it quite a curse that made her feel like a fraud. For decades, she'd kept writing, but sealed everything in a box, carrying it from dwelling to dwelling as a tortoise lugs its shell. When Sally arrived trembling with shears, ready to open the box, she feared being sucked back into dark chapters, particularly a story about contemplating suicide at 13. Reading a poem from 1980, she wept when it was praised. Over weeks, she transferred everything to her computer, each session rich with vivid recollections. Discovering 66 love poems to Austin, a brief, passionate affair that ended badly, she considered burning them. The response was horror. Transforming dung into beauty is artistic triumph. By revealing her shame about the affair and Austin's bondage rituals, something she'd never shared with anyone, she felt enormously liberated. That night, she dreamed of clean laundry, no more dirty secrets to wash. When she finally brought the dreaded bus story, it was actually a new story she'd written about a kind bus driver helping a young girl. Rather than giving up hope for a better past, she'd written herself a new one. Her parting words resonated deeply. "It's not so hard if you've got a kind bus driver." During a Hawaiian writing retreat, an email arrived from patient Ellie announcing she had begun voluntarily stopping eating and drinking to hasten her death from terminal cancer. 5 months earlier, at 63, and facing her final chemotherapy options for ovarian cancer, she insisted, "I don't want you to define me as a cancer patient." Ellie developed powerful mantras. "I'm alive now, and that matters. Life is temporary, always, for everyone. And my work is to live until I die." She became a pioneer of dying for loved ones, modeling how to die with dignity. Despite her illness, she found unexpected benefits, feeling like a scarce commodity, experiencing greater confidence, and following advice to enjoy every sandwich. Her profound reflection, "My work is to love my body, all of it, this assemblage of atoms that is failing at the one essential job of life, to stay alive," revealed how she faced mortality with grace. Reading her words exposed an uncomfortable truth. While believing in being fully present with her, there was unconscious distancing with thoughts like, "You're the afflicted one, not me." This self-protection created a barrier, missing the opportunity for deeper encounter. These stories converge on a singular truth. The most vital thing offered in therapy isn't technique or theory, but an authentic healing relationship from which people draw what they uniquely need. What they share is the courage to face what most spend their lives avoiding, that we are creatures of a day. Marcus Aurelius wrote these words nearly 2,000 years ago, yet they remain startlingly relevant. We are temporary, we will be forgotten. Yet within this truth lies unexpected freedom. When we stop running from mortality and turn to face it directly, something shifts. Time becomes precious, relationships deepen, authenticity matters more than image. Our finitude isn't the problem, it's the teacher. Every meaningful moment exists because our time is limited. To accept this isn't to give up, it's to wake up. What would you do differently if you truly accepted that you too are a creature of a day?